Hello, everybody. You are listening to Limited Playtime, the board game podcast where we bring you board game reviews in 30 minutes or less.
Or the next episode is free.
Except that we're not doing that today.
I know.
Because it's one of those episodes that's divisible by 10.
Yeah.
And what do we do when we do a number divisible by 10, Jason?
We do a list.
Sometimes. Most of the time.
Most
right?
of the time.
Yeah. Something special, right? And we happen to love lists here at Limited Playtime. We like putting them together. We like, you know, coming up with our 10 favorites of something, or our 10 most excited of something, or the 10 worst of something. and today we are doing, between the two of us, our top 10 Grail games. Jason, what is a Grail game? I'm sure there's plenty of listeners out there that do not know this phrase. Does it mean that these are games produced by one of the two Grail companies that I know, Holy Grail Games or Grail Games?
Not necessarily, although they could be.
Could be.
So, I mean, the definition kind of depends on who you ask, I guess. But generally speaking, Grail games are games that are or have been for you unattainable, but that you really kind of really, really want. You know, maybe they've gone out of print and they're like super expensive. And I mean, you could get it, but it, you know, might not be worth it to spend that much money.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even necessarily have to think it's a really good game. It's just probably just a game that, you know, it's like the white whale, you know?
Yeah, I think that most of these games are games that either have very small print runs, and so there's very few copies out in the wild. They're out of print entirely because maybe like it's something that had a license back in 1988 that has never been picked up again.
Yeah.
Or it's just something that goes a long time in between print runs. And so, you know, like there's just an inflated value in the market. If you want to go pick up a copy that's new or even used, sometimes it can still be hundreds or thousands of dollars, depending on what we're talking about.
Sometimes.
Yeah. So Jason and I each picked five. He sounded like he had a pretty good idea of what games are his Grail games when we discussed this. And I was like, I have no idea what my Grail games are, but I'll sit down and I'll give it a think. And so I've come up with five, and Jason's come up with five. I'm going to go first because I feel like my list might be a little weaker than yours. I don't know.
Sure.
I mean, just because I didn't already have, you know, like five games in my head that are what I consider Grail games. But when I sat down and thought about it, there's at least two on here that when I thought about it, I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. Like if I ever found one of those out in the wild and it wasn't $1,000, there's no way I wouldn't come home with it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, like I came up with three more games that, you know, I think I'd be very excited to find. A little bit more difficult to find. So, my number five game is a little game that we recently played called Space Hulk.
Oh, yeah.
So, Space Hulk has had multiple reprints, but it's been around since the 80s or the 90s.
I think.
It's a Games Workshop game that takes place on a Space Hulk, which is like a very massive intergalactic, or not intergalactic, but, you know, like intersolar spaceship, right? Interstellar spaceship. That I don't really know all the lore on this, but it's part of the 40K universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can speak up here too, Jason, because you actually own this game, right? You own Space Hulk.
Yeah.
We played it at your house. I had never played it before, but when we played it, I was like, oh, this game is kind of special because there's a lot of games out there that are sort of dungeon crawlers that are very like dice chucker, light rule set sort of dice chucker games, but this one feels to me like it had the most approachable rule set while not sacrificing fun in some sort of like, you know, meaningful way. We had a really good time playing it at your house.
It was a lot of fun.
And there's other games that sometimes I feel like the game just kind of like a game like Zombicide, right? Like it has a relatively light overhead rule, right? Or rules overhead, but the game can still kind of grind a little bit as you're playing it. You know, games like that, oftentimes, I feel like they don't really perfect the balance of light rule set with still some amount of fun strategic depth.
Yeah.
And this game, I think, kept it light enough and just deep enough to make it entertaining for, like, the hour that we played it. So that, combined with the fact that it's the 40K license, which I've suddenly become very obsessed with, has me wishing that it was in print right now, and it's not. And has me now thinking I need to keep my eye open for the next time that it's out in print and grab a copy while they're available, because Games Workshop is notorious for having incredibly short print runs, and like, you know, things are available for like maybe 6 months in stores and then they're gone for another like 5, 6, 7, 10 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of had a similar experience because the first time I played was when the first edition was released, which I think was like in I think it was like 89 or something.
Uh-huh.
Because my uncle had it, and so this is the uncle that actually kind of got me into like niche board gaming.
Yeah.
And he had a copy of this game, and we played when I was a kid, and I had sort of been on the lookout for it ever since. Of course, I didn't have a lot of money, so yeah. Even if I did find it, I don't know how I was going to manage to buy it. But when the third edition was reprinted quite a while ago now, I snatched it up.
yeah. So I mean, like, to speak a little bit more about the game, you're playing, one player plays as a group of Space Marines, and you're sort of like combing this giant ship for whatever goal the mission has set up for you. And the other player is playing Gene Stealers, I believe. Basically, like, they look like the Xenoform from Alien, right?
Yeah.
So you're just basically flooding the ship with these monsters that are then, like, you know, attacking the Marines. And the Marines are trying to mow them down faster than they can reach them with their guns. Because the Tyranids, or the Gene Stealers, have blades for arms or whatever. And so, like, they engage at melee range, whereas the Marines can engage at melee or range.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like a little bit of a race, a little bit of, like, a strategic positioning puzzle in terms of where you're going to put your guys and position them for combat. There's, like, a little bit of variance with the weapons that they can be equipped with and everything. You know, meaning that there's slight variance in how many dice they roll or you know, like, whatever special abilities get thrown in there. But you don't feel ever bogged down with options or too many of those sorts of, like, you know, differences between all the different units and everything. So
yeah, and I mean, in addition to their strengths, so like Gene Stealers have a sort of more melee strength, and the Space Marines are more range strength. They also have certain drawbacks. So like the Gene Stealers are like very mobile,
yeah.
Whereas the Space Marines, their mobility is incredibly limited.
yeah,
but like even turning, take
right,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
to face a different direction takes
whatever,
action
yeah.
points. Yeah,
right. Yeah. So I had a great time playing that, and I think I'm definitely going to want to copy when I finally get an opportunity. So that is my number five, Jason. What is your number five Grail game?
Okay, so my number five Grail game is actually two games.
Oh, you did a cheat too?
I did
a cheat at number three.
Yeah, so I actually, this is not my top five, it's my top six. But I group these two together because they're sort of, I mean, they're not exactly the same game, but they're part of the same series of games.
Uh-huh.
So there's this series of games that came out in the early 2000s. That was designed by Wolfgang Kramer and I think Michael Kiesling, maybe even the other one. They were published by Ravensburger, and they're called the Mask Trilogy, mostly because the covers of the boxes looked like masks, even though I'm not sure they were supposed to be. and they're and the three games were Tikal, Mexica, and Java. Tikal, I believe, is still in print, and I actually have a copy of Tikal.
Yeah, that sounds familiar enough to me.
Yeah, and I think there's actually even a digital version of Tikal. The other two, however, Mexica and Java, have been out of print for a long time. Mexica did get a brief reprint a few years ago, and I can't believe I missed it. And as far as I know, Java has never been reprinted. So they're all kind of variations on the same theme. There's like an action point system. There's a bunch of exploring, some, you know, so point salad kind of stuff. There's also, Mexica in particular has this sort of like building mechanic where you actually build temples instead of just explore ruined ones, which is kind of fun. And so, partly for the completionist part of me, like, I want to have all three of the Mask Trilogy games.
Yeah.
But partly also because I really like Tikal as a game, and these games are supposed to be pretty similar. I kind of, you know, that's why I kind of am on the lookout for these.
Is Java about programming? Is it a coding game?
No, it's about the island of Java.
Oh, okay.
That one, I think Java is probably the oldest one, if I remember right. And it's one that has never been reprinted. And it's probably also the least popular, which is probably why it's never been reprinted.
And so it means it probably never will get that reprint, unless suddenly a bunch of people crawl out of the woodwork at the same time and say, hey, we want this.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
There's sort of an unofficial fourth part of the Mask Trilogy, which is Torres. Torres is also designed by Wolfgang Kramer. It's not thematically like Mexica or Tikal or Java, which are all about you know, Mexican Tikal, sort of Aztec, sure. Mesoamerican.
Yeah.
Taurus is about building castles, so it's quite different. But I guess sort of mechanically, they're sort of the
same.
And I actually really enjoy Taurus. I do have a copy of that.
So it would show up as maybe like in the re-implemented as line on BoardGameGeek rather than the like part of a family line or whatever.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you run those names down one more time just in case people want to actually hear this and keep in mind what these games are and look into them for themselves.
Oh, so the two games that are out of print are Mexica and Java. The third one of the trilogy, which I believe is still in print, is Tikal.
Okay, so Mexica, Java, and Tikal.
Yep.
Got it. Okay. Number four. My number fourth Grail game is Cave Evil.
Cave Evil? I've never heard of this.
Cave Evil. You should look Cave Evil up, Jason. I Google it right now or whatever if you need to. Cave Evil is it's like a little indie game that I think it came out like close to 10 years ago, maybe more than that, something like that. It's been out for a while, and it's had, I think, fairly limited print runs. There's sort of a sequel game to it called Cave Evil Warlords, I believe, that I read that can be like implemented with the original Cave Evil and uses sort of the same basic system, but you're controlling like a warlord with a bunch of war bands instead of a single necromancer who like creates a bunch of like, you know, like summons monsters or whatever to you, and then like everybody's basically playing necromancers in this crazy like black and white dungeon and like sending like units out against each other. I've read that it plays almost like what you would imagine like a real-time strategy game playing like as a board game, right?
Yeah.
But it's all just done with this like sort of like, remember back in like the 80s and the 90s when you'd walk into like certain stores and there'd be like a bunch of like black and white heavy metal like zines or magazines or whatever.
Sure.
And it was all just like a bunch of like, you know, like demons and monsters and, you know, like skeletons and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah,
it looks like those, right? It looks like the black and white pewter stuff that you would find at the weird game store, you know, like in the one corner of the mall that most people didn't go to. You know, it looks like one of those sort of like punk rock, I don't know how else to say it, but like this sort of like punk rock movement in board gaming, right? Where you've got like a bunch of stuff that's bucking the trend of like the current trend of having like incredibly polished artwork, incredibly polished mechanics, incredibly polished like components. And instead it's like cardboard standees, you know, like on hexagonal cardboard, like dungeon tiles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, with just like just an immense amount of like, you know, like classic Ameritrash mechanics thrown in to make like a heavily thematic experience that you just don't get anymore, right?
Yeah.
And that appeals to me because we spend so much time playing these refined you know, like elegant games all the time now. Even like sort of the America, the closest we get to Ameritrash might be, you know, like a Fantasy Flight or like, you know, like a Cool Stuff Inc. game or something like that.
Yeah,
a CMON,
sure.
Game. Not Cool Stuff Inc. CMON, right?
CMON. Yeah.
That's probably the closest we get. And even compared to like classic games, those are fairly well designed now and fairly elegant. I mean, we're usually when we say, oh, this CMON game is kind of middling or whatever, like in terms of the design, we mean by today's standards, right?
Mm-hmm.
But compare that to something like HeroQuest and suddenly like it looks like an amazing game design and everything. And so when I see a game that is just like, no, what if we went in the other direction, right? What if we spent the last 30 years going off in the total, just like, you know, Ameritrash mechanic direction rather than trying to integrate Euro type mechanics into everything. I feel like this is where you end up, is with Cave Evil. And I've been incredibly interested in it ever since I discovered it a few years ago. And every now and then I check back in with the website to see if they have reprinted it or if they're ever going to.
Yeah.
Or if I should just buy a Warlords and see, you know, like if that's gonna scratch whatever itch I have. But that's it. That's Cave Evil. I haven't ever caught it in stock, the original. But that Warlords one is, so maybe, maybe I need to grab that. I don't know.
I'm just looking at the pictures of this game now, and it's like, it's totally punk rock.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It reminds me a little about that Night Cage game that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, well, and I think I even mentioned this game when we were talking about the Night Cage, because I think what I mentioned was like this sort of art, this aesthetic has been appealing to me lately in a way that it hadn't in a long time, right? And I think the part of it is nostalgia. Part of it is that we were teens in, like, you know, the early to mid-90s. And, you know, and even before our teenage years, when we were preteens or whatever, we were still poking our heads into game stores and comic book stores. And so in the late 80s, like very, very early 90s, we were – we were being exposed to this aesthetic, and so there's a part of me that's just like, oh yeah, this, like, this feels good, this feels comfortable, yeah. You know,
I feel like I might have seen some of this art on like a t-shirt at Hot Topic or something.
Maybe, I don't know. Hot Topic might actually be too modern for this. like I'm pretty sure there was a place called I know there's a store called the Wizard's Keep in Muncie, Indiana, but I feel like we had one in Fort Wayne. It might have been like the Wizard something else, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was like this weird, you know, musty game store that like was just the walls were lined with pewter miniatures, and they had all kinds of like, you know, like D&D type games like wrapped up in plastic wrap and everything, like, oh, up, yeah, on the shelves and everything. And that's the sort of place where I remember seeing this aesthetic, you know.
Yeah.
Along with several other things, one of which we will talk about later on my list. So,
oh, yeah. Intriguing.
All right, your number four, Jason.
Oh, okay. So my number four is a game that is quite beloved by many, actually, which is Warhammer Quest.
Ah.
So this game came out in the mid-90s, again, mm-hmm, with the Games Workshop sort of very limited print run kind of thing. And as far as I know, they've never reprinted it. They have recently sort of released things under the Warhammer Quest name, but they are not the same game. The only one I can think of is Warhammer Quest Silver Tower at the moment. But there's
a Cursed City just got reprinted.
Oh yeah, that's one of the newer ones.
You might actually be able to find that right now if you went to a store, because I've seen it in stock at multiple game stores in the Indianapolis area over the last month.
Yeah. So Warhammer Quest was the initial iteration of that. It's sort of, a lot of people say it's like a step up in complexity from HeroQuest. And the thing that I think that, so I've never actually played this game. I've always just sort of seen it and looked fondly at it. Mm-hmm. but it looks amazing. You know, it has all those great Games Workshop miniatures. There's like a ton of them in there.
Amazing in a 1995 way.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it has. So Games Workshop has like really great detailed miniatures. In the 90s, they were not as detailed, but they still, to me, were like cool as hell.
They were really detailed for the time.
For the time, yeah.
The big difference between then and now is they were squattier, I think.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to build them because they were made out of metal.
Some of them were plastic.
The ones that came in games typically,
yeah,
were.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the thing that, you know, sort of stands out to me about this game, particularly as a game from the mid-90s, is that, you know, it's a, I guess, fairly typical kind of dungeon crawler. But one of the things is that there's no set dungeon map. It's sort of, the game is randomly generated, I guess, every time you play it, which to me in the 90s sounded like the coolest thing ever.
That's a roguelite, or a rogue.
A roguelike. So yeah, it was this, you know, game that was sort of infinitely replayable. There was a leveling up system, so like your characters like carried over from each time you played, which again for me was unheard of in the 90s. And it came with this huge array of like really cool looking minis and like tons of cards and board tiles and all that. I had never seen a game like it, and ever since then it's sort of stuck in my mind as one of those things. Like, if I can get this for a decent price, I would probably.
You had the HeroQuest, like, infection, right?
I did.
It left you with the fever that required something that was a stronger drug. And when you looked at that box, you were like, this is it. This is my heroin.
Yeah, exactly. Except I was a teenager and had no money, so.
Right. That was a problem.
It was a problem.
Yep, we left a lot of beautiful things on shelves back then.
I know. For me, most of them are from Games Workshop, actually. There was there was a sort of game/hobby store that my uncle used to take me to called War and Pieces. And they had like a full line of Games Workshop games. Yeah. I have several of them, but you know, I couldn't get all the ones that I wanted.
So one of the themes that I discovered, that I've been discovering over the last 6 months, is that I've been an unknowing Games Workshop fanboy my whole life. I didn't realize how many properties they had their hands in growing up that caught my eye, or that I was actually, you know, invested in the case of HeroQuest, that, you know, like that basically came from them, or at least was, you know, like a partnership in the case of HeroQuest with Milton Bradley.
They've been
in my life and I didn't know it for a very long time.
Constant companion.
Yeah. Okay. So Warhammer Quest, right?
Yep.
Warhammer Quest, yeah. Yeah, I'm curious what the differences are, or what the similarities maybe are, between the more modern versions of that and the ones that were out in the 90s. I'm sure that there's at least some carryover, maybe just in terms of, like, probably basic mechanics, like roll to hit, roll to wound, you know, like the way that Warhammer has their whole, right, like, three-step process to doing an attack. Something like that, I think.
I actually have Silver Tower, and I haven't played it.
Oh, wow. Should break that out sometime.
Someday,
when we have,
yeah,
time. Yeah, I mean, I'm very curious about those games. I keep looking up reviews for them because I don't want to take... They're like $200, so I don't want to take a $200 plunge on,
right,
something that is, you know, going to be underwhelming and a dungeon crawler that just doesn't, you know, compare to some of the other dungeon crawlers that I already have in my library or could bring into the library.
Sure.
So I've been gun-shy as far as picking up those Games Workshop co-op dungeon crawlers go, but you know, if they're good enough or the models are amazing or something about it is enough to make me excited, then I think I'd be pretty happy to get one, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, number three on my list, this is my cheat, so actually this is a list of 12.
Oh my god.
Well, between the two of us, right? Because I guess actually,
oh, yeah,
13, because you had three games.
I thought you meant this one for you was 12.
No. I have two games listed for number three because they're so similar, right?
Yeah.
It's no big secret that I like World War II enough that I have, like, you know, a little fondness for a good World War II game, you know, like a good World War II movie, whatever. So in high school, we had a game of Axis and Allies going in one of my friends' basements, and I have very fond memories of that, and I've never owned a copy of Axis and Allies. I've looked up what the deal is with Axis and Allies these days, because you can't just go out and buy Axis and Allies anymore. There's, like, half a dozen different versions of Axis and Allies. But the one that everybody has said is the one to get is Axis and Allies Anniversary Edition, which has only been printed twice. Once in 2008, once in 2018. I didn't grab it when it came out in 2018 because I wasn't really sure I needed a copy of Axis and Allies or that there would ever be anybody that would want to play it with me. And I'm still not. But I think that were I to get one, I would want to pick up that Axis and Allies Anniversary Edition if I could find it for a decent price. Like, I looked and, like, it's already going for, like, $300 on eBay, right? Which is, like, just ridiculous for a copy of Axis and Allies. Like, yeah. I don't need a copy of Axis and Allies that bad. But, right, I just wander into a game store, like, in the middle of nowhere where, like, there's low traffic or whatever, and they just happen to still have a copy on their shelf for $100. Mm-hmm. I'd probably snag it, you know?
Yeah.
But if I wanted to get a game that is a little bit more modern in design and a little bit more complex, then what I would do is I would pick up War Room, which is designed by the same person. I believe his name is Larry Harris. And War Room has had, I believe, two print runs, and I think they are just about to deliver their second print run, which was Kickstarted or crowdfunded or something a year or two ago. And currently you can't pre-order it on their website. They say that they have their pre-orders frozen because they're so low on the stock that they know they have, that they're waiting to see how much they have left over after they've fulfilled all the copies that they owe people.
Yeah.
So it'll be a difficult game to get. It's also like one of those games that takes all day or maybe 2 days to play and like takes like a massive table. It's like a massive circular map showing the entire globe, right? And like, you know, in the state of war in World War II and everything. And it's one of these games that has like, if you can order like those sticks that people use in the movies to push the units around on the maps and everything. It's meant to emulate that experience as much as possible. And looks incredibly complex in terms of like, you know, like there's all the economy going on with the world and, you know, like different units and doing research to develop like, you know, like stronger units and everything for World War II. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that Axis and Allies does, but it looks like the big boy version of that, right?
Yeah.
And so War Room has fallen on my radar in the last couple of years, and I think that were I not to ever be able to find a copy of Axis and Allies Anniversary Edition, and I felt like I was going to be able to play a World War II game with somebody someday, then I would probably also be interested in picking up a copy of War Room.
This sounds like a crazy, crazy game.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it's the sort of thing that I think would be fun to like leave set up in a room somewhere, like I did in high school, and just come back to it every week with the group that's playing through it, and you know, like take as long as you need to play through the game. You know, just like play 3 hours a night or whatever for, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks in a row, whatever.
Yeah.
But I'd be down for that. That'd be cool.
Awesome. So what was the game War Room?
War Room, yeah, or the Axis and Allies Anniversary Edition, right, which is also a big, you know, like, more highly produced experience than the typical Axis and Allies game. And probably is like a little bit more approachable, I'm guessing, in terms of rule set than War Room is. But yeah. But they both look amazing, and they both look like they would scratch that particular itch that I get sometimes for World War II games. So
cool.
All right, what's your number three, Jason?
All right, so my number three is another Euro game. It's
Euro game.
It's called San Marco. It's a game from 2001, designed by Alan Moon. Again, another Ravensburger game, like Mexica and Java. So this is primarily an area control game set in Venice, and there's some sort of, you know, building and influence of nobles kinds of things going on. So you build bridges and canals, and you curry favor with the Doge of Venice and all this kind of stuff. A lot of things that you might see in other board games that have kind of a similar setup. The thing that's, well, there's a couple of things about this game that are really attractive to me. One, this is when I first started sort of re-getting into the hobby, is when this game came out, and I saw the game, and it's beautiful, it's stunning. The board is colorful, and nicely constructed, and then there's these little like plastic bridges that you build over the canals, and then there's like the Doge figures, and then the little, you know, colored cubes everywhere, and it was really kind of amazing to look at.
My brain keeps breaking when you say Doge.
Doge.
Yeah, because of
Dogecoin,
cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
What was the name of the game again? I'm gonna look it up right now. I need to see it.
San Marco.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing that's kind of interesting, I think, about this is that the meat and potatoes of the game is this system where somebody is sort of elected the decision maker for the round, and they basically dole out the resources. They take the cards that the resources are on, and they sort of make different piles according to how many people are playing the game. You know, there's sort of like the wheat and the chaff in each of these things, and the thing is, like, it's really tempting to be able to put all the like really meaty stuff into one particular pile of cards, but the catch is that the person who's the decision maker doesn't get to choose a pile of cards until the end. So there's really kind of an incentive for you to balance out each of the card piles, so that one person doesn't end up running away with everything. I think it was sort of a clever way of trying to balance that kind of mechanic out. Other than that, I mean, I think it's, you know, sort of a bunch of, you know, action cards, build bridges, move guys, you know, score regions, blah, 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 that kind of thing.
It's interesting because I looked at the board and my immediate reaction was Concordia. And the way you're talking about scoring zones and stuff like that, it just, I don't know, like I'm getting a very Concordia vibe out of all this. And that's not a bad thing.
No, Concordia is a good game.
It's a great game. It's one of my favorite Euros.
But does it have little plastic bridges in it?
It does not. It does not. Those plastic bridges look pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like the colors on this board.
Yeah, me too.
It's pretty. Yeah. I dig it.
Yeah, so that's my number, what are we at? Three. That's my number three.
We're number three, somewhere. We've got two to go. Or four, if you're counting for real.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, San Marco. Okay, final two here. My number two is a game that I've never played. I've never seen it in real life. But the board, or a picture of the board, used to be the banner for the subreddit, the board game subreddit. And I used to stare at it, and I would be like, what is that game? I need to know what that game is. I think it was the mobile version specifically. And eventually I found out that it was the second edition of Merchant of Venus. Not Merchant of Venice. Merchant of Venus. The Fantasy Flight published version of Merchant of Venus, which is like a pick up and deliver game set in space.
Yeah.
Have you seen the board?
No, but I'm looking it up right now.
Yeah, look it up right now. It is one of the best-looking boards I think I've ever seen.
Wow, that's crazy.
I mean, I'm a sucker for space, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's no secret. But the board for Merchant of Venus, second edition, just, like, it appeals to me, like, in some sort of, like, I don't know, like way that is just, like, central to my like sort of like aesthetic, right? Like the sort of like art aesthetic that I enjoy in terms of sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Like the big glowy sun, the way that it just kind of radiates out, and like, you know, the way that they don't just use black for the space parts. There's a lot of blue and stuff. There's like a whole star field behind all of this, like, and there's these paths going around all the different like planets or whatever that you can go to in your little ship that are like dotted and all these different colors. And it just looks like a game that if I were to see it at Gen Con,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't have time to actually try it, I would just end up buying it and taking it home because, like, it would appeal. Like, when I saw Bunny Kingdom, right? I was like, oh my God, this is the most adorable thing I've ever laid my eyes on. I have to bring this game home. And then I played it, and I was like, eh, it's okay. You know? that might happen with Merchant of Venus. I don't know. But were I to ever see a copy for an affordable price, I would totally snag this because it looks amazing. I love the artwork. And also, I like pick up and deliver enough to be interested in playing that game. So that is my number two. It's something that's been on my radar ever since I discovered what it was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I even tried to get it in a math trade that I did at Gen Con in 2019. That was one of the games that I wanted to get when I went to that math trade, Jason.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was putting up some kind of rare games to try to get it, like out of print stuff, like, Game of Thrones, the Gears of War. I had the old Fantasy Flight Gears of War game that's like out of print. And I was like, maybe this will get me what I want. And it didn't. But it got me some other stuff that I enjoyed. But I still wish I could grab a copy of Merchant of Venus for a decent price. So
that's two things about this. One, it's funny that this is how you discovered that game, was through the banner on the
board. I know. Yeah. Yeah.
the second thing is that when my neighbor from across the street, they moved a couple of years ago, but he was also a big, board game person.
Uh-huh.
He gifted me a copy of the first edition of Merchant
of
Venus.
Oh,
So I do have the first edition. I'm sorry, I don't have the second.
Yeah, it doesn't look as good.
I actually tried to sell it a while ago. I don't know if it actually sold. It may still be in the basement.
Yeah, it's an Avalon Hill
version
of the game.
Yeah.
It's got the square punch out. It looks like a GMT game or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, not as attractive.
No, not definitely attractive. Not.
No. Maybe still fun. I don't know. Maybe mm-hmm. we should try playing it sometime.
Sure, why not? Well, all that why time not? We have.
Unless I get, the second edition, in which case you can just throw it in the trash. Just kidding. Don't do that.
I won't do that. Yeah.
Okay, number two, Jason. What is your number two?
Okay. All right, so my number two is another Games Workshop game. This one's from the late 80s. It's called Curse of the Mummy's Tomb.
I think we've talked about this.
I think, well, when we first started talking about this list. So Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, they sort of published it at the same time that they published games like the first edition of The Fury of Dracula, Dungeon Quest was in there somewhere, like the third or second edition of Talisman. So it was like during their heyday of, you know, those properties, and this is one of the ones that I guess didn't do very well. I'm looking at it right now and it's only got a rating of 5. So this is one of those games that perhaps is not a great game, but for nostalgic reasons, probably. Yep. And plus I own, again, the completionist in me, I own a lot of those other games. So this, it kind of sticks in my craw that I don't have this one.
It looks like there's an expansion for it. Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, : In Search of Eternity.
Oh yeah. Let me see how that search goes.
It has 4 additional characters. Dr. Chai Sen Fong.
Oh, that's not racist.
Idaho Smith. Quote unquote Dodger Fagan. And Mycroft Lestrade.
Okay.
Yep. That's where we're at.
Their creative name nomenclature things were.
I feel like they've reused those names somewhere, at least the Mycroft Lestrade and Idaho Smith.
So I did end up playing this game once because my uncle that I keep talking about, had it, and we played it once. And the thing that blew my mind is that the board is 3D. It's played on 3 different levels.
Yeah.
Which again, this was, you know, 1989 maybe. and so I was like, you know, I when I played board games, it was usually with my sister and we played things like Clue and Monopoly. So when I played this thing and I was like, oh, it's played on 3 different levels and I have a character that has individual powers and It's not just, you know, the game isn't just land here and buy this thing. It's like you have to evade an enemy and collect, you know, these relics and whatever else. It seemed really, really cool to me. So it's another one of those things where it's like probably I'm remembering it way more fondly than the game is actually worth. But I can't explain it. I just really want
that right there, though. That right there is this list.
Yeah, like, for sure.
Your Grail games often are dictated by some sort of nostalgia or some sort of like unfulfilled wish that you had as a child, right?
Yeah.
That's where most of the games that I was inspired to like at least consider for this list were in some way something that like at some point like, you know, elicited joy or lust or whatever out of me while I was in a store, and I just never got around to getting that game, or I couldn't afford it because I was a kid, or, you know, like my parents were going to buy me an $80 board game in 1995 or whatever,
right?
And so like that's what this list is. That's what drives this sort of like Grail game mentality, is that level of nostalgia mixed with sort of a, I don't know, like curiosity, you know, about what you didn't get, what you didn't try, what you haven't experienced in life.
Yeah.
In terms of board games.
Yeah.
Which is a dumb thing to get caught up on, but I mean, you know, like we're human, so.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't make logical sense. It's just, right. You know, one of those things that just is just part of my soul.
Yeah, yeah. So before we move on to number one, I would like to just do an aside here and say that 3D board,
yeah,
really reminds me of the 3D castle you build for Drakenturm, which is Dragon Tower,
yeah,
which is a child's game, but it's ages 5+. Okay. We do have it, and if you want to look it up, it's Drachenturm, Drakenturm. It has this like 3D tower you build, and there's a little princess at the very top of it, and you have to like build scaffolding with these like warriors, these like knights, to like rescue the princess from a chubby dragon that has like, he has a rock that's supporting the scaffolding, I believe, and he is like slowly pulling the rock away, right? There's like a little mechanical thing inside,
yeah,
the dragon.
I see this.
That reels the rock in, and so it's like you have this race against time to like rescue the princess out of the tower.
Oh my god.
Once you've constructed the scaffolding, you have like this little like stick that you have to like guide her down like this path to get her out, otherwise everything falls and the princess dies or whatever. I don't know. Milo and I used to have a blast playing that together when he was a little younger.
Oh my god, this game looks hella fun.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it might appeal to you. I mean, I honestly, like, it would be sort of like when we played what was that? Magic Maze, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
It's a little bit like that, because there's, like, this real-time element to it, and you're like, get out of my way! Get out of my way! You know, like, I know what to do! You know, like, I can do this! You know, like... So it's got a little bit of that. I think it's actually pretty fun, so... Drakenturm has a very similar-looking 3D board.
Man, now I'm... Thank you for this, because now I have to justify why I want to buy it.
I mean, you can try it here when you come out for Gen Con this summer, but yeah, it's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. Okay, number one, my number one Grail game of all time. So this is a game that if I were to ever walk into a Salvation Army, a Goodwill, a garage sale, I don't know where else I would find it that it wasn't $1,000, but the game that I would most like to have more than anything in the world, and there's not a good reason for it, not at all, is Advanced Hero Quest.
I almost put that on my list.
I know that it's basically just like a half step in between Hero Quest and what you said one of your games was, which is Warhammer Quest.
Yeah.
It's basically just like this in-between space between those two things in terms of game design. And I don't think like anybody was falling in love with it mechanically when it came out in the 90s. It's like 1995, maybe? I don't know. It might be earlier than that. But... it was one of those games that when I walked into the Musty Game Store and looked up at that shelf and saw Advanced Hero Quest, being a massive fan of the original Hero Quest, I was just like, well, that looks like the thing that I am going to get when I'm an adult. Because my parents aren't going to buy it for me.
Yes.
And then, of course, you become an adult and it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's out of print.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing lasts
but Advanced
forever.
Hero Quest, that was the one game that I would just look at and be like, oh, you know, had the, yeah, like the angelic voice in your ear or whatever, and just being like, that is the promised land right there. Advanced Hero Quest for big boys. And I've never ever touched it other than maybe like holding the box in the game store and taking a look at it while, you know, it was still sealed up or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like if there were ever going to be a game that I would just be like the most excited I could be to find out in the wild and not have to pay $1,500 for it, as I looked, and that's about what it's going for on eBay if you actually have like a near complete copy, it would be Advanced HeroQuest. I can't think of a game that I would be like more excited to see, and entirely for nostalgic. This is a thing that I couldn't get when I was a kid, and I don't think I'll ever actually have a chance to see it in real life. Reasons. It's Advanced HeroQuest. And it might be a terrible game. I may like play it once and be like, well, done with that now. But I guarantee you there's nothing I'd be more excited to find like a holy grail.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I get that. I mean, it's a similar thing with Warhammer Quest for me. Like, I had that exact same experience they were describing, and I've never played the game, and it could be terrible. I have no idea.
The rest of these games feel largely attainable, right? Like, if I wanted to buy Merchant of Venus, I could probably get it for $150 used or whatever, sure. Or maybe even new.
Yeah.
You know, there's still copies of it floating around. It's only 10 years old. War Room and Axis and Allies Anniversary Edition are both out there in the wild for a few $100s, or I could wait for the reprint and get them for, like, the $100 or the $200 that they normally cost.
Sure.
That's attainable. Cave Evil, who knows, right? Maybe it'll get reprinted. There's the other version of it. Maybe that's good enough, you know?
Yeah.
And Space Hulk, I feel pretty confident will get reprinted someday.
But Advanced HeroQuest, like, 4 editions.
Yeah. They'll have a 5th, right? I mean, they'll get there.
Yeah.
That property is too popular to just never ever do it again.
Yeah.
But Advanced HeroQuest will never be reprinted. There is a 0% chance that that game is ever coming back in any form other than, like, you know, fan recreations or something like that.
That's really unfortunate.
Well, I mean, it's just what it is, and that's why I feel like it's my number one, is because I feel like it would be the most grail-like of everything.
Yeah.
It's not because I think it's going to be the best game out of that list. I think that that's probably, you know, like, probably Merchant of Venus or Axis and Allies or something like that, you know? Like,
yeah, for sure.
Maybe. But the... You know, like, I can go find those if I really want to. Yeah. I just have to pay more than I think it's worth, so. Yeah. What is your number one game, Jason?
Okay, my number one grail game, which I think will probably never happen, like, this will never occur, is I would like to have a fully functioning 1981 edition of Dark Tower. Dark Tower was this game from the early 80s that had a plastic black tower in the middle that had a pane of glass and a rotating carousel of images on the inside. And it had like a sort of like a membrane keyboard that you could interact with the very rudimentary computer inside the thing that would run the game. And you would, you know, press the button for the action that you want to do. The carousel would spin. One of the light bulbs would light up to show you one of the colored panels to show you what would happen. So say you like moved into an unexplored territory, you press the button that said, "Hey, I moved," it spins and maybe nothing happens. Maybe you encountered plague. Maybe you got lost. Maybe you, encountered a roving band of murderous brigands. Maybe you get attacked by a dragon. There's all kinds of stuff that going to happen. The point of this game was to sort of make your way through the four different kingdoms, collect 3 keys, a gold, a silver, and a brass key, with which you could then return to your home kingdom and open the Dark Tower and fight the nameless evil within. Along the way, you could explore, like, go to the bazaar and buy certain supplies. You could explore some ruins or a tomb, or you could go to the Holy Sanctuary, and maybe they would give you something out of the goodness of their hearts. And that was the entire game. And I loved it.
Yeah.
My dad had a copy. I played it to death. My friends and I played it to death. Literally, it ceased working one day, and it was like, you know, the sun had gone from my life. To this day, I still have the original figures from that game, like, because when my dad threw it out, I refused to have him throw out the whole thing. So I was like, I'm keeping these player figures. So I still have them. I have the new edition that was released by Restoration Games. It was either earlier this year or
it was earlier this year. Yeah, it's pretty recent. Yeah,
yeah. And I have it, and I played it, and it's a decent game, but it's not the same. Yeah. And the thing that like sort of sells this for me the most is sort of just like the cherry on the top of this thing is like, yeah, I'm nostalgic for it. Yeah, I really enjoyed playing this game. It defined a large portion of my childhood. The artwork in this game is, first of all, all the art was done by Bob Pepper. If you don't know who Bob Pepper is, he was an illustrator who did basically like cover artwork for a lot of sci-fi and fantasy novels in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So he illustrated a lot of stuff for like Philip K. Dick, Isaac Asimov, the horror writer Harlan Ellison did a bunch of stuff for him. And he did all the artwork for Dark Tower, and it's freaking amazing. I love it. If I could get a poster of that artwork, I would be like the happiest person.
You know, I feel like one of the things that we're missing in our lives that we had in the 80s and the 90s is like Van-worthy fantasy sci-fi artwork.
Yes. This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And yes, and I just loved it. I found the game fascinating. I found the artwork compelling and just drawing me in, and I loved every single second of it. And the reason this will not happen ever again is because, again, this is a computer from 1981. I'm fairly certain none of them work anymore.
Jason, I mean, you know that I've been kind of in the pinball community now for good, like close to, I don't know, like 7, 8, 9 years. I mean, we keep a lot of machines running that should be like long dead. It's entirely possible that the fault in the electronics in that thing, it's just something that you could easily replace, like a transistor or something like that, or like, you know, like just a diode or something. Like it's entirely possible that if you start kind of like Googling where to stick your multimeter in that thing to try to like narrow down where the problem is, where the fault is, that you might actually be able to repair it.
Somebody might be able to repair it. I likely would not. I do not have the technical expertise to make that
your husband
happen.
Could do it. I could do it. I mean, like, there's somebody that you know that could do it, and it would just be like an evening project or something.
Man, if I could make that happen.
Do you have it still?
No, my dad threw it away.
Oh.
So I'd have to get the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. That's a drag.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I bet we could fix it, but not if you don't have it.
No. Plus, I'm pretty sure that my dad never, like, after he thought that it was dead, he never took the batteries out of it, so I'm fairly sure.
Oh, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. That's an easy fix.
What, battery corrosion?
Oh, yeah. That's easy, yeah. You just, like, scrub in there with a toothbrush and, like, some lime juice or some lemon juice or something. Yeah, you just need something really acidic. And that cleans it up real easy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not a problem. Don't worry about that. next time batteries explode in some sort of compartment, don't worry about it. Don't throw the thing out. You can clean that up. You just need some like highly acidic something, right? And a nice brush to get in there and just scrub it all out. It'll be fine.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, if you find a broken tower somewhere, hold on to it and we'll figure it out.
Okay.
All right.
You've given me renewed hope.
Dude, like, there are pinball machines running from, like, with, like, you know, motherboards, like, you know, EM machines from, like, the 1950s, and they're still running. So, like, for sure we can get that thing running as long as the parts that control the actual logic aren't dead.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. Sorry? Well, that was it. That's
it.
I don't know. I don't know how many games we talked about tonight. It was definitely more than 10, but there you go. If these are games that you'd be interested in, you know, like if you're just like, wow, these sound really cool, I'm going to go check them out. That's why we brought it up. We thought it'd be fun, just a fun thing to talk about. And, you know, maybe these are games that you'll keep an eye out for when you're wandering through a Salvation Army or a Goodwill or whatever, where people are, you know, like throwing their treasures away. Because every now and then you get lucky.
And if anybody out there is listening and finds a copy of Dark Tower, I will give you my firstborn child.
Yeah, I mean, if you come on the right day, I'll just give you my firstborn child because
he already has one.
Know, really? He's getting under my skin sometimes, but not really. But you know, if you found a copy of an Advanced Hero Quest and you're like, I don't need this, but Kyle would love it, then you know, like that would be awesome, and I will thank you. But I will keep my child.
I guess.
Yeah. All right. If people would like to get a hold of us, Jason, and they'd like to tell us what their Grail games are or why our Grail games are lame, how would they do so?
All right, well, to tell us why we don't know what we're talking about here.
I was going to say, if they want to get a hold of me and be like, why didn't you talk about Torpedo Run, Kyle? Why didn't you talk about Screaming Eagles? Yeah, I mean, those were going to be my games, because I was like, these are games I wanted as a kid, and I never got them.
Do they still make that game Crossfire?
I don't think they make it. I actually had that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I just felt like, I don't know, like, if I say out loud, I wished I had those games, and then somebody got them for me, I don't know if I really want them. You know what I mean?
Nice, lovely gesture, but...
Yeah, do I really want to be burdened with a copy of Torpedo Run, which is like, I don't know, like the... It's like the size of, I don't know, like three other board games put together. How would they get a hold of us?
All right. Well, to give us more things we don't need, you can you can email us. It's podcast@limitedplaytime.com. You can go to the website, limitedplaytime.com. You can tweet us at limitedplaytime or go to Instagram at limitedplaytimepodcast.
I might actually like a copy of Torpedo Run now that I'm thinking about it. I have kids, you know.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Got to shoot those discs at something. I should wait until Timmy's a little older. Otherwise, they're going to be gone forever. He'll eat them or something.
Yeah, right.
Screaming Eagles, though, that looked both really cool aesthetically and boring mechanically, so, yep.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back in, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, probably? It took us 3 weeks to get this one out, so I don't want to make any huge promises. But I don't think, we haven't been going longer than 3 weeks at a stretch, so you should be able to expect us within 2 to 3, so.
Sounds good.
And we'll be back with a review of something.
Something.
Then.
Yes.
All right. All right. Bye, everybody.
Later.